You're listening to Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking this hour about science and poetry. My guests are poet Len Germanara and scientist Dr. Sarah Oktay, both from the Nantucket Field Station, where they have kind of a nice personal and professional partnership going on. Husband and wife running the station and doing your poetry and introducing not only those who visit the island, but also students of varying ages to the power of poetry for conveying scientific and environmental ideas and our connections to the natural world. You know, I've often heard from artists the idea that while we think that of science as being very much a discipline with rules and structures for how we do it, perhaps our misperception of art, and you've said that there are no rules in terms of what you write about and perhaps what your end product is, but there is a discipline to it, right? There's a discipline and a structure to how you go about doing it. Mm-hmm. So talk about some of those techniques.
Well, first and foremost, to be a writer, you have to write. And a lot of times what I hear from people that want very much to be writers is that they don't have the time to do it. And so that first discipline has to be in finding the way that you're going to sit down and put pen to paper. And whether that be set the time of day or the particular kind of thing that's going to happen when you sit down and write, that's important. You need to give yourself permission for that as well, that to take that time. And then with the eco-poetics that I taught, I was asking them to give me the date, the time, the weather, and any other pertinent information that might be necessary if you're going to go back after you've written what you've felt. And say, okay, yes, that was on a Tuesday, and it was very hot that day, and that might be the thing that's important, or it was very cold that day. There was a day this, it was mid-December, and it got very, very warm, and Sarah and I were talking to a couple of folks that were visiting the field station, and I don't know any better. I thought, well, let's go and see if we can find any snakes, because I knew that the kid that was with us was always asking Lenny, are there any snakes around? And Sarah said, well, you know, it's kind of cold out. And you're trying to talk him down from the ledge. And I said, well, let's go take a look. And we went and took a look, and we found a snake, sure enough. And it's just that even, you know, against all, you know, rational thought to go and look for something, I think it's
almost a deliberate naivete.
Yes, yeah. And you'll go and stumble over something. You might not go and stumble over it. You know, it just happened to be that there was a snake there that day. But we were going to discover something by going and looking.
Well, and that applies in science as well, of course, that essentially this deliberate naivete can sometimes, the new eyes can sometimes be very important to making a breakthrough in a field where we think we know it all.
That's very true. I mean, every time I think about this, I think about how it exercises our brains and our ability to observe. And that's one thing that poets are really good about doing, is looking around at the natural world and just simply observing. That's actually one way that I test out new students and new interns, is just bring them into the lab and just see how much they observe looking around. And poetry really exercises that part of the brain, the part of just looking around and seeing everything. In our field notebooks, in fact, I have my students that are doing science write the weather too. They'll write the date, the time, the weather, if it's sunny, if it's windy. And a lot of times they're like, why do I need to do this? And I'm like, 10 years from now, you're going to look back at that and go, I had a weird reading on my salinity, but it was super windy. Maybe it was, you know, so you get information from some of the things Len is saying, and you get this discipline of trying to write down all your observations. That makes the moment more real.
I wonder, in comparing what might be written in a poet's notebook versus a scientist's notebook, if you're writing down the weather of the day, I can imagine that the scientist's notebook, it's going to be, it was 10 degrees C and the wind was 15 knots and, you know, it was 30% cloud cover, and, you know, very precise, but attempting to in some ways be very disconnected from it. And perhaps the poet's notebook might or might not have any of those numbers and might be something to the effect of bone-chilling cold, very windy, cloud-studded sky. I mean, do they end up looking the same if you're trying to just talk about something as simple as the weather, or do they end up looking completely different?
A lot of times, and I'll let Sarah speak to, you know, what it looks like in a scientific journal, but a lot of times my journal, I mean, I have a journal here with me, and it looks like the note that Rocky J. Squirrel used to pull out of the bottle, and it was all squiggly lines and just pretty much indecipherable. And that's my kind of a notebook, and that's, I think, an artistic kind of a notebook, not following the lines. And I think that the scientific specific would probably be a little bit more in between the lines, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, as opposed to 1, 7 over here, 23 over there, and none of the other numbers in between because they're not relevant.
So literally, even just the layout of the notebooks might look completely different.
Yeah, that really cracks me up because I think that is very true. I think scientists, you know, are always thinking, well, you have to print. The next person needs to read it. We're probably thinking more often about being able to share our logbooks and our data and being able to read it 5 years later. So we're certainly very specific and particular about our handwriting. And so I think ours are probably not as entertaining. It would be a cool exercise to actually have a scientist and a poet walk together or go do sampling together and then have them record the experience in a lab notebook and show them side by side. I think that'd
be pretty
fun.
Do you guys not ever do that?
We until right now, no, not quite. I mean,
I'll show you mine if you'll show me yours.
Yes. The poet, you know, the students come out and we do a nature walk with them. And sometimes Len and I will do it together and I'll explain some of the science. And he knows nature and science well enough that he doesn't really need me to be there. But sometimes we do it together just because we can play off of each other. And I am thinking scientifically most of the time. And he's thinking almost lyrically most of the time. So a lot of times we'll speak to a group and kind of play off each other in that way. But we might need to do that as an exercise. I think that'd be fun.
Can't hurt.
Now, Len, you had picked another poem that you wanted to read today called Historic Numbers of Right Whales Skim Feeding Off Cape Cod.
Yes. And just a little side note on this. This is from Elizabeth Bradfield, who is a writer in residence at in Provincetown at the moment, and both an accomplished naturalist as well as a Stegner award winner. So she's an accomplished writer as well as an accomplished naturalist. And this had just happened when she came, and she shared this poem with us. She was one of our guest lecturers for the last semester, and she came down and gave a master's level class on ice in the Arctic and the whales and all of the other wonderful things that were happening in her life. And this poem is called Historic Numbers of Right Whales Skim Feeding Off Cape Cod. And I think anybody down here on the Cape remembers this kind of thing happening. So already have a little bit in your head. Who would expect their appetite would come to seem ominous? But now I know they are voids of hunger. They plow a field of plankton, turn, plow again. They strip the water like loggers on a clear cut. The bay this spring seemed overrun by stern, enormous beetles. Black, vaguely military, inexorable. Poor plankton, adrift in flailing clouds, poor blushing copepods with delicate antennae, watermelon scent. You don't stand a chance. I am stunned week after week. Right whales eat the bay down until they have to leave it. Time and proximity have made them monsters. This must be how it was before.
It's such a completely upside-down perspective from how we usually talk about the right whales that visit Cape Cod Bay every year around this time of year. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about how endangered they are and what we need to do to protect them. And this just completely turns that on its head and almost makes them seem like monsters.
Yeah. Yeah. And watermelon smelling.
That one, I have no idea what that refers to, honestly.
I love the fact that it's introduced there, you know, to be taking all of that in and then to have a smell associated with it. And it's so sort of discordant, you know.
Well, and it would really help a student remember exactly. Now you're not going to forget that right whales eat copepods and plankton. Mm-hmm. You can see that image. That's a lot better than me saying a right whale will travel 200 meters and eat copepods and scoop them from that. This is such a strong image that you're going to remember the science behind that much better than anything I could say.
And the mowing back and forth across the bay.
It's
and
very and just, accurate, yeah.
Well, I want to thank both of you so much.
Thank you.
It's
for a wonderful conversation. All right. Len Germanara of Spoken Word Nantucket and the Nantucket Field Station, and Dr. Sarah Oktay, the Managing Director of the Nantucket Field Station. This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone.